This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Today, it's all about trade policy. Okay, not all, including a new kind of farm aid. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, July 24th. Thanks, as always, for being with us. Let's start with that farm aid. The U.S. Agriculture Department announced a $12 billion package today of emergency assistance for farmers hurt by President Trump's trade policies. American farmers are facing retaliatory tariffs from China, the EU, and Canada. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is with me now from Washington with details. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Amy.
So what do we know about how this money is going to be spent?
So the USDA is planning to spend it on three programs, the first one being direct payments to farmers, including those raising soybean, corns, wheat, dairy, and hogs. The second, buying excess products, which would then be distributed to, say, food banks or nutrition programs like SNAP. And then the third is developing new markets to help make up for those markets that have been lost to the tariffs that the administration has put out.
Okay, and what kind of reaction has this proposal received so far?
It seems to be thanks, but farmers and farming groups are welcoming the relief, but still emphasizing that it's not what they want. The American Farm Bureau said in a statement, quote, "Our emphasis continues to be on trade and restoring markets, and we will continue to push for a swift and sure end to the trade war and tariffs impacting American agriculture," end quote. This is also a tough move politically. Many Republican members of Congress are having some sticker shock and a tough time swallowing the idea of an expensive payout to farmers for what they see as President Trump's trade war, even if it benefits their own constituents. So, for example, Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse said in a statement that this plan is basically gold crutches for farmers, and farmers would much rather, quote, win by feeding the world.
Okay. Kimberly Adams on the farm beat for us today. Thank you.
You're welcome, Amy.
The trade saga continues tomorrow with a visit to Washington from the European Union's top official and a meeting with President Trump. Jean-Claude Juncker, head of the EU's executive arm, will try to stave off a full-blown transatlantic trade war and persuade the president not to go ahead with a threatened tariff of up to 25% on European auto imports. From our European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now on the high stakes of tomorrow's meeting.
Europe's largest economy, Germany, sells the U.S. $35 billion worth of cars a year. President Trump's proposed tariffs, says Stephen Booth of the Open Europe think tank, would hit the Germans where it's already hurting.
You've got the diesel scandal and you've got a potential no-deal Brexit, which would also hit the car industry as well. So I think that section of German industry feels very much under pressure.
One potential peace offering, Jean-Claude Juncker could address America's complaints about EU tariffs on American cars. At 10%, they're four times higher than US tariffs on European vehicles. Daniel Gross of the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels.
For Germany, it seems natural to offer Trump a reduction in European car import tariffs.
But any US-EU deal would need the unanimous assent of all the bloc's members. States like France or Italy have weaker car industries, and they want to protect their home markets from American imports.
And therefore, it's not a foregone conclusion that Germany will get its way on this particular issue.
But even if it does, many Europeans fear tomorrow's Trump-Juncker meeting will come to nothing. Ian Bond of the Centre for European Reform.
It seems rather unlikely that anybody can offer him anything that will convince him that this is anything other than America's partners trying to cheat America.
The fear is that President Trump will not be satisfied until the EU's entire $150 billion trade surplus with the US is eliminated. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, higher company earnings, higher stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. House Democrats introduced a bill today aimed at making higher education more affordable. Among many proposals in the bill, a federal-state partnership would provide 2 years of community college for free. The bill, of course, isn't likely to travel far in a Republican-controlled Congress, but it does give Democrats something to pitch to young voters and parents in the midterm elections. Tuition-free community college is an idea Arne Duncan pushed while he was Secretary of Education under the Obama administration. Secretary Duncan's got a new book called How Schools Work, about how his nearly three decades in education shaped his views, starting with the after-school program his mother ran on Chicago's South Side.
My sister, brother, and I grew up literally from the time we were born in my mother's after-school program, which she started in 1961 on the South Side here in Chicago. And we just grew up as students in her program. We were taught like all the other students, and her philosophy was that 10-year-olds taught 5-year-olds and 15-year-olds taught 10-year-olds. So we grew up, you know, teaching and being taught all our lives. And what I've seen is that children who, you know, might happen to be very poor, might happen to not always have the most functional families, when they have an opportunity to get a great education, where they're surrounded by people who love them and have high expectations, it's unbelievable what they can accomplish. That's what's driven my passion all my life, is to try and level the playing field, to create some equity around opportunities for kids in communities where historically they've been denied that simply because of their race or their zip code.
You write in the book something that struck me, though, that children's social, emotional, and physical needs should be met by schools before their academic needs. Are we expecting too much of schools, though? Is it fair, you know, to blame teachers or hold them accountable for test scores when many of those needs aren't being met?
Are we asking too much of schools? I think possibly we are. But I always say, if we don't do it, who will? So when I ran the Chicago Public Schools, we served tens of thousands of kids 3 meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that was one of the first things I learned in my mother's program. She fed, the minute kids came into her center, she fed them. Because if your stomach's growling, it's hard to concentrate. This isn't about, you know, laying blame or pointing fingers, but we as schools, we as social service agencies, we as churches, we as nonprofits have to make sure that kids are fed, that they feel safe. And when we do all those things, then let's talk about algebra trig and AP biology and going on to college. But if those things aren't being met, we put a real limit on what our kids can accomplish.
Well, I think that gets to the cost of education. We in this country spend, what, about $1 trillion a year on education? And you say that's not enough. Why not?
Yeah, I fundamentally see education as an investment, not as an expense. The cost of not educating is so much higher to society as well as to individuals on the backside of all this. And if we were willing to invest in high-quality early childhood education, if we were willing to pay great teachers and great principals significantly more, the benefits to our society, the benefits to our economy, the benefits to our democracy, I think would be extraordinary.
And yet, obviously, money isn't enough. I mean, in your own education department, the $7 billion school improvement grants program had a pretty mixed track record. One study found there were no measurable gains in math and reading scores, graduation rates, or college enrollment. How do you respond to that?
Money's never enough, so you'll never hear me say it's only about money. For me, it's always about, you know, high expectations as well as high support. And we have to hold ourselves accountable for great results. When schools aren't working, we have to be willing to challenge the status quo. So investment is part of it, but high expectations have to go with that. And we have to hold ourselves accountable as educators for results. Absolutely.
Are you willing to concede the failure of that school improvement grant program?
I wouldn't say I was a failure at all. I visited many, many schools that were dropout factories, schools that weren't safe, that turned around and transformed. And we would love to have seen more success across the board, but you never give up on kids. You never say this is good enough when there's a 50% dropout rate or where there's huge violence in school. You have to be willing to challenge that status quo. So would happily make those investments and challenge things when they're not working again in a heartbeat.
All right. Arnie Duncan was U.S. Secretary of Education during the Obama administration. His new book, How Schools Work, is out August 7th. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Have a great day now.
Just heard Arnie Duncan's thoughts on what happens with kids at school, but what about the things children learn at home? Marketplace tech host Molly Wood has been reporting on the ways technology impacts kids today. Whether it's Amazon's Alexa, Google Home, or robotic toys, those devices have real consequences for our kids. Molly, good to have you on.
Hi, Amy.
So, Molly, the more we're talking to robots and our children are spending time with them, what is this doing to our social skills?
Well, MIT researcher and Professor Sherry Turkle has a lot of thoughts about this and has done a lot of research into empathy and communication. The problem really is that these devices are designed to entice us, to make us think that they're our friends. They laugh at our jokes. They give us positive feedback. And the concern is that kids won't necessarily know the difference, that they are just learning to have these, what she calls human conversations, and that they will start to have conversations with devices that are not appropriate, or that they won't understand how empathy is supposed to work in the real world because their interactions with these devices are not real.
Well, yeah. And I have a friend I was just talking to about this who worries her kids are treating these devices like digital servants and kind of being rude to them. Although I don't know if you can be rude to a robot.
I asked the same question. I said, well, I don't want to teach my child to be rude to Alexa or not be nice to Siri. And she said, look, it's the responsibility of these companies not to design devices that speak to us as though they are real humans. And, you know, one thing that is particularly a concern for parents is that the more secrets we tell to these devices, the more they can advertise to us, right? And we need to be giving an appropriate amount of information and learning the difference between interacting with a machine and interacting with a real person. That doesn't necessarily have to mean we don't have any manners, but it's also important to understand that, you know, an Alexa device doesn't require a please and a thank you.
Companies are, though, deliberately targeting children, right? Are they making these robots kind of besties for our kids?
They are. And so that is the uphill battle. You know, it really is, as Sherry Turkle calls it, a design decision on the part of Apple or Amazon or Google, for example, showed off a tool in May, and it sounds like a real human. And so I think the real question that designers of these tech products need to ask themselves is whether there's a need to make things sound so human. Sure, we like it, but it's like that movie Her. You know, there are always going to be some people, and those people might be children, who are especially vulnerable to the idea that they can't tell the difference between real human emotion and the kind we get from robots. And so the ethical choice might be to make it very clear when we're talking to a robot.
All right, Molly Wood, our host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.
Coming up,
you do have big city police departments now wanting to quantify, wanting to analyze sentiment.
How do you measure trust? But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were mostly higher as markets reacted to strong corporate earnings. The Dow picked up 197 points, or 0.7%, to close at 25,241. The NASDAQ lost 1 point, barely changed, to finish at 7840. And the S&P 500 was up 13 points, or 0.4%, to end at 2820. Investors liked the quarterly earnings report from Alphabet a lot, and so Google's parent company clicked its way to a gain of 3.8%. We talked about trade and farmers. Well, appliance maker Whirlpool is being hurt by tariffs on imported aluminum and steel. It fell more than 14% after reporting weak quarterly results and cutting its full-year forecasts. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Some 80,000 chemicals are registered for use in this country, so you might be surprised to know the government has banned only 5 chemicals in the last 4 decades because of health risks. A couple years ago, Congress beefed up the toxic chemicals law, and the government made plans to restrict the use of one, dubbed TCE, that the EPA considers a human carcinogen. But under the Trump administration, that effort has been delayed. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports from the town of Beaverton, Oregon, outside Portland.
Amanda Evans Healy remembers her dad having one of the best jobs because it was at the toy factory.
He was creative director.
Specifically at the Viewmaster plant outside of Portland. It made those red 3D picture viewers that were once the rage. She meets me at the site. It's now a strip mall. But from the 1950s to the 90s, it was a toy fantasy land. One day,
we all gathered in the front employee parking lot, and a helicopter landed, and Mickey Mouse and Pluto and Donald Duck got out, and that was huge.
Later, in her car, she says her father worked there more than 2 decades, and then in 2001, he was diagnosed with liver cancer.
And he said, well, I'm not feeling too well, and I think it's related to the water I drank at work.
3 years prior, the factory announced that its water was laced with a toxic chemical trichloroethylene, or TCE. The factory closed in 2000. Now, all across industrial America, TCE has been used to clean grease off of metal pieces of machines and auto parts and toys. For 2 decades at the Viewmaster plant, the workers dumped the used chemical on the ground, where it leaked into the drinking water well. That's according to a 2004 federal report.
It just was worst-case scenario. We found out at Thanksgiving 2001, and he passed away shortly after Valentine's Day.
This report from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry estimated up to 250,000 Viewmaster workers may have been exposed to TCE. Federal and state studies have found TCE linked to cancer elsewhere, at the Camp Lejeune Marine Base in North Carolina, and a toxic dump site in Massachusetts. That's the subject of the movie A Civil Action, starring John Travolta. He plays a lawyer for pollution victims seeking restitution money.
I'm not going to just throw out numbers so you can say no to them. You'll have to come up with a number.
8 million.
But at the Oregon Viewmaster plant, just 5 workers got settlement money from the company in 2011. That's including the family of Amanda Evans Healy. She says others didn't sue or that the statute of limitations ran out.
How do you think about all the families who didn't get anything?
I feel horrible. I really, really had hoped to do a lot more. I still hope someday that something can be done.
One of those somethings to her is banning TCE use. The EPA declared it a human carcinogen back in 2011. And 2 years ago, it proposed a ban for certain uses, including cleaning metals, which became a problem for some companies. Toxic chemical expert Jason Marshall at the University of Massachusetts Lowell says companies have long loved this chemical.
They didn't have to think about what they were doing with the cleaning. They just dropped it in and came back and it was clean.
And many companies have invested in pricey degreasing machines that use TCE.
When they have a large piece of equipment that costs them millions of dollars, they're not willing to drop that solvent if they've just purchased this.
Chemical industry lobbying groups challenged the EPA position, arguing that the agency's direct link between TCE and cancer is, quote, erroneous. The Halogenated Solvents Industry Alliance, representing TCE makers and users, wrote the EPA saying, quote, we judge the epidemiologic evidence to be neither convincing nor strong. This past winter, the agency under the Trump administration took the proposed TCE ban and moved it to the, quote, long-term action list, along with 2 other proposed chemical bans. What does that mean? Scott Faber is with a nonprofit environmental working group.
Hibernation, indefinite delay, storing it away in your attic.
There's an enormously strong record that TCE is a known carcinogen. So there was really no reason for the administration to delay these bans.
Two industry groups, the American Chemistry Council and the Halogenated Solvents Industry Alliance, declined comment for this story. The EPA told us in a statement that TCE uses in the proposed ban will now be folded into a longer-term evaluation. Still, Washington chemical law attorney Lynn Bergeson says the real world is already changing. Home Depot, for instance, is removing products that have TCE. She says companies make these calls often.
They can make a decision based on their own appetite for risk and their commitment to simply not supplying products that contain chemicals that are believed to pose risk because it's against their corporate creed.
Even though that may not be far enough for those seeking to ban TCE for good. In Beaverton, Oregon, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The national conversation about policing and trust and community is ongoing. A Brooklyn-based startup called Elucid has partnered with the NYPD to develop a tool they say could help improve relations between cops and the public. Simone Weichselbaum wrote about it for the Marshall Project in a piece called Yelp for Cops. And it kind of works like that. Surveys pop up on people's smartphones asking how they feel about their local police, and then that data is compiled into a trust score. Simone, what do the cops do with that if, say, the trust score drops on the Lower East Side?
So that's the interesting part of this. So when I push back with the commissioner of the NYPD and one of the heads of the LAPD, based on my reporting that, you know, this is really confusing, even A, how you're getting these scores, and then B, you know, as commissioner or deputy chief of big police departments, what do you want your commanders to do? So what was interesting is the top brass really didn't have a clear answer. Their answer was, oh, let the commanders figure it out. So it was interesting reporting out the story. The biggest critics were actual police commanders who were very frustrated that, hey, you know, our bosses aren't telling us how to respond. And do we really need this tool? Like, if I go to a local community meeting where I talk to my beat cops, I can also tell that my, you know, people aren't happy with us at the moment. Like, why do I need a tool?
And you did find at least one police force that has a response plan for using this data. Talk about Grand Rapids and what they're doing.
So it's a smaller police department. It's not, of course, big by any means compared to New York or LA. And their chief said, I'm going to use this as a tool to determine where I can send my community policing resources. So if scores are down in a specific area of his city, he'll figure out, well, maybe I should have a backpack giveaway. Maybe I should have a car seat giveaway. And my favorite solution was a police karaoke car. And I was like, what's that? And that's when you send out a patrol car to a neighborhood and encourage the kids to come over and sing songs with the officer over the loudspeaker. So it's a little gimmicky, but he at least had a response that he mapped out and thought about. And when I interviewed the police commissioner last here in New York and explained Grand Rapids, and he was like, no way. Like, you know, I don't want to drill this down to like gimmicky things like giving away backpacks. Like, I want my commanders to have responsibility. I want them to really come up with creative solutions. And that's why we're not going to give out a playbook. This is up to the commanders to figure out their unique neighborhood and how to respond.
And how representative are these surveys, particularly if they're happening mostly online on social media versus, you know, a beat cop walking the street talking to people?
Right. Whoever these people are, people clicking on, whether it's popping up on a gaming app or it's popping up on your Facebook. So you're a certain type of person, whether you're a millennial, whether you have time on your hands, whoever you are, do you represent like an average resident of the city? Question mark. But the other side of this is that it's low cost and cheap to do. So traditional surveying is really expensive and takes a long time. So those who actually are into this idea feel, well, you know what? It's not the greatest, most statistical gold standard of surveying. We understand that. But it's cheap and it's easy. So let's keep building this out.
Huh. So if we could pull back for a second, just from a law enforcement and public safety standpoint, I mean, is this a sign at least that police forces are taking issues of trust and public perception more seriously?
Yes. There's a positive, you know, story thread here. So the first thing is you do have big city police departments now wanting to quantify, wanting to analyze sentiment. And that's a good thing. And their ultimate goal in New York and LA is to roll this out into CompStat. So, you know, as you're presenting your information that week or that month about murders in your precinct, in theory, one day perhaps, you will also be asked about your trust numbers or your satisfaction numbers. And perhaps one day you will be asked in front of, you know, a big room of the top police officials, what are you going to do about it? And perhaps one day you will be, you know, held accountable that last month your numbers were this when it comes to trust. This month the numbers still down. What are you doing? So that is what they say at this point is the ultimate goal. And accountability in policing is always a good thing.
All right. Simone Weichselbaum, a staff writer with the Marshall Project. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And you can hear more of our conversation online at marketplace.org. This final note, Ivanka Trump, the brand, is on its way out. The president's daughter and senior advisor announced today she's shutting down her fashion line to focus on her job at the White House. In the past year or so, retailers like Nordstrom, Sears, and Kmart had dropped the brand's products, blaming declining sales amid a boycott of Trump-branded goods. Trump removed herself from day-to-day operations after her father's election, but held on to the company through a trust. The decision leaves 18 employees who will be out of work. And that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow picked up 197 points, 0.7%. The NASDAQ lost 1 point, barely changed. And the S&P 500 was up 13 points or 0.4%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of on demand. And I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good night, everybody. Kai back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.